The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to finally welcome our guest this evening. I say finally because we've invited Sam many times before, but up until now we haven't been able to make the dates work. But this time the stars were aligned. And I mean that scientifically, not mystically. As I'm sure you know, Sam Harris is the author of the best-selling books, The End of Faith, Letters to a Christian Nation, The Moral Landscape, Free Will, and Lying. His writing has been published in more than 15 languages, and his articles have appeared in the New York Times, The Economist, Newsweek, and many other publications. The recipient of a degree in philosophy from Stanford and a PhD in neuroscience from UCLA, Harris is also a co-founder and the CEO of Project Reason, a nonprofit foundation devoted to spreading scientific knowledge and secular values in society. Tonight, he joins fellow Stanford grad and anchor of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition, Tamala Edwards, to discuss his latest bestseller, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Please welcome Sam Harris and Tamala Edwards.
Good evening. It's great to have you all here. And just so you know, I've been talking you up. I told him he's not going to get a better crowd than he will in Philadelphia. And I'm sure that will be true.
Well done.
So, Sam, I'm sure a lot of people here know some of your previous work. This is a little bit different, many people might find. And a central tenet of it seems to be this idea that there's no minotaur in the maze of your brain. Another you looking out, though. Yeah. How much of our day do we spend talking to ourselves? Sometimes we have something in our ear, sometimes we don't. It's a constant conversation, so this idea that there's not this duality is interesting, that there's no other you.
Yeah. It's first, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. The starting point for any inquiry into spirituality, into just any domain of experience, science, basically every human project starts with this sense that virtually all of us have of being subjects inside our bodies. We don't actually feel identical to our bodies. We feel that we have bodies. We feel like we're riding around inside these bodies as though they're a kind of vehicle. And if you're like most people, you feel like you're in your head. You feel like you're a locus of consciousness in your head, a thinker of thoughts, a feeler of feelings, an experiencer in the center of your experience. You don't actually feel identical to experience. And that point of view, it turns out, doesn't survive scrutiny. It doesn't make neurological sense, as you just suggested. There's no place in the brain for your ego to be hiding. And it doesn't make experiential sense when you look closely enough for it and actually find that it's absent. And meditation is the technique, classically, that one would use to do that, and there are various types of that. But anyway, the book is my discussion of why it makes logical, philosophical, and scientific sense that our subjectivity would be that way, but also how we can, in a first-person way, explore it and discover the sense of self is illusory.
One of the interesting things you get into with your background in neuroscience is you spend a lot of time talking about the brain and how it's built and what you call the split brain. Mm. And on page 73, this was a sentence that stayed with me. It's one thing to say that you're unaware of a vast amount of the activity in your brain, basically the idea for the movie Lucy. It's quite another to say that some of this activity is aware of itself and it's watching your every move. Tell us more about this idea that there could be a part of your brain that's aware of you that you're not aware of.
Yeah. Well, this is somewhat speculative, but it it actually makes sense. It's hard to banish the speculation once you see its basis. So there's this phenomenon that's been known about in neurology for over 50 years called the split brain, where people, for the most part, who have grand mal epilepsy get a surgery which bisects the corpus callosum and other white matter tracts that link the two hemispheres of the brain. This is to prevent the storms of unregulated neuronal activity from sweeping from left to right or right to left and engulfing the whole brain. So it actually does mitigate their seizures significantly. And so it's not a common procedure, but it's scores of people have had it. And initially, it seemed like nothing really happened to them. It didn't seem to change them apart from mitigating their seizures. And so there was some time there where people were wondering whether the corpus callosum did anything, because other than just hold the two halves of the brain together. But then Roger Sperry and colleagues in the 60s and 70s created an experimental paradigm that could present information selectively to one or the other hemisphere. And when they did this, they found that was almost certainly the case, that there were two areas of conscious life that were functionally segregated from each other. And there are many ways of demonstrating that that's the case, and I talk about them in the book. One clear demonstration is that in a certain number of people, there's linguistic ability on both sides. And so there was one famous case where a child was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he said he wanted to be a draftsman, I think. But then he said that with his verbal left hemisphere, but his surprisingly verbal right hemisphere spelled out race car driver with letter cards simultaneously. And you can get, and it's not only strange deficits that people get with this, once this procedure is done, they actually have competences that normal people don't have. So for instance, if normal people with connected hemispheres can't simultaneously draw two different pictures with their right and left hands, but people with a split brain can. You can draw, you know, a chicken with one hand and a house with another, and just those efforts go on simultaneously. So it's a very strange thing. But the only reasonable conclusion to draw from these split brain studies is that consciousness can actually be divided with a knife. So that once you have this procedure done, there's something that it's like to be the left hemisphere, and there's something that it's like to be the right hemisphere. They both have different points of view, and neither knows what the other is up to. And so now if you buy that, and I think virtually everyone buys that, then once you admit that the corpus callosum isn't sufficient to perfectly integrate what's going on both sides of the brain, then you wonder what's the consequence of this lack of integration? Because if it just seems that 200 million fiber tracts that we have are not sufficient to integrate the simultaneous activity of more than 10 billion neurons on either side of the cortex. So then we could be functionally segregated in ways, and it might be true to say that there are areas of the brain that are conscious, differently conscious than you feel yourself to be in this moment. And it actually gives a picture of a kind of Freudian division of one's mental life, which is inconvenient because Freud, we all wanted to retire Freud as quickly as we could.
In the book, you have, you could say, two tent poles. There's a value to meditation, and here's what it does, and here's why it doesn't have to be linked to spirituality.
Right.
Let's take the first one, the value of meditation, separating it out from any religion. Mm-hmm. What did you find, and you use it in your own life, to be the value?
Yeah, well, it does come down to the difference between being lost in thought and not. So we spend our lives continuously lost in thought, and we're thinking without knowing that we're thinking. And this automaticity is what gives us this feeling of self. And it's it also has a very strange structure to it. So you think, most of us feel that we are thinkers of thoughts, or that there's a thinker in addition to the next thought that arises in consciousness. But much of our thinking takes the form of a kind of dialogue where we seem to be playing both sides of the conversation. So again, I'll come out here and I'll look at the water glass and I'll think, oh, good, there's water there. But I can see that there's water there. Why, who am I informing? You know, is there somebody else inside me who can't see the water? And much of our thinking takes this form, where we are, just imagine what it would be like if your thoughts were broadcast on a speaker for everyone to see. You would sound completely insane. And actually, part of the one of the threshold differences between a normal crazy person like everyone in this room and someone who's clinically insane is an inability to suppress that internal speech, that the people who are talking to themselves out loud are, unless they're wearing a Bluetooth headset, crazy. But we have that same speech internalized. We are having a conversation with ourselves, and it's not necessarily sane. It's totally normal, but it's not necessarily sane, and it's certainly not optimal in that much of what we say to ourselves is decidedly unpleasant. We are ruminating about the past. We're worrying about the future. We are judging ourselves and other people ceaselessly. Maybe you're different than I am, but you know. You just think interesting and happy thoughts all day long. But for me, it's like I've been kidnapped by the most boring person on earth and forced to have the same conversation over and over again. So meditation is a way of breaking that spell. Meditation is a way of noticing for all of your experience, but in particular the arising of thought as just another phenomenon in your conscious experience, and to recognize that consciousness is the prior context of everything you experience, including thoughts themselves. And if you do this clearly enough, you can recognize that consciousness itself doesn't feel like I, it doesn't feel like an ego, it doesn't feel like a self. And that feeling of self is, in fact, what it's like to be identified with the next thought that simply arises uninspected in consciousness. And so a meditation is a way of scrutinizing that situation closely enough so that you actually feel the relief from being ceaselessly identified with your thoughts from one moment to the next.
And in the book, you talk about how being in that state, normally if we have happiness, it's a fleeting thing, mm-hmm. whereas this can get you to a point where happiness can be more constant. Is it happiness, really? Is it contentment? What is it that the meditation is getting you to?
Yeah, it's definitely not happiness in the excited, the best thing that has ever happened is about to happen sort of feeling, but it's peace. It's no longer being disturbed by anxiety and fear and anger and just all that, just the cramp of self and self-concern in each moment. And it can be quite ordinary. It could just be the clarity of noticing that whatever is arising isn't fundamentally changing the quality of consciousness. So that, in some sense, consciousness is not harmed by negative experience, and it's not improved by positive experience. That which is aware of anger or depression or sadness is the same thing that's aware of joy or excitement or compassion or any classically pleasant mind state. And if you keep dropping back into that mere witness of your experience, then the changes become a little less captivating, or a lot less captivating, and so there's a kind of equanimity there, and a freedom from a problem that would otherwise motivate you to seek happiness by some strategy in the future. So it's not that you don't want pleasant experience anymore. It's not that you can't. You know, if you're brought before a buffet, it's not that you can't figure out what you want to eat because you've got no preferences anymore. But it's a way of finding a kind of well-being before anything happens, so that your well-being no longer seems contingent upon some change that you're seeking out in the next moment.
You had a back and forth with Dan Harris at ABC mm-hmm. talking about both of your books, which were touching on meditation. And Dan said, look, you know, just from a basic point of view, it's like going to the gym. I go to the gym because I want to work out my muscles. I do meditation. It was an opening door. Mm-hmm. It could make me better. But in the book, you talk about the fact that people could start to look at this as very transactional. I'm sad, I'm angry, I'm lonely. Mm. This will just get me over. It'll be my Band-Aid. But you say it's important to distinguish between accepting unpleasant sensations and emotions as a strategy while covertly hoping they'll go away and truly accepting them as transitory feelings and consciousness.
Right.
What is the difference between doing it just as a means of almost not feeling something and truly getting the value out of the meditation?
Right. Well, one question. How many people here have any kind of meditation practice or have experienced meditation? Okay, how many haven't? Well, let's just take 2 minutes so that I can introduce you to what I'm talking about here. So just sit comfortably and maybe a little straighter than you are. And you can close your eyes and just take a moment to feel the weight of your body resting in your seat. Just let gravity settle you into your seat. And become aware of the sensations of breathing, whether the tip of the nose or the rising and falling of your abdomen. Just feel wherever you feel the breath most distinctly. And see if you can feel the next inhalation from the moment it arises, and just cover it with your attention. And it doesn't matter if the breath is shallow or deep. It's not a breathing exercise. It's an exercise of attention. You don't have to control the breath. Now, as you notice the sensation of breathing, you'll also notice that you hear sounds and you feel other sensations in your body, pressure and warmth and tingling. Just notice all these things as they arise in consciousness and change and pass away. And the moment you notice you're lost in thought, see if you can see the thought itself just unravel, whether it's an image or a bit of language in the mind, and then come back to sounds or sensations or the breath. Okay, so now you can open your eyes. So that was a brief introduction to a technique of meditation called mindfulness, which comes out of the Theravada Buddhist tradition in a teaching of practice called Vipassana, which is the Pali word for insight. And what's especially good about mindfulness as a practice and why it's been adopted in clinical settings and in scientific research very widely at this point is that there's nothing you need to add to your experience to do it. It's just a matter of paying close attention to whatever is in fact arising. There's no mantra, there's no imagery you have to become fond of. You don't have to take on any of the iconography of Buddhism or any other religion. And again, it really is, there's nothing you have to assume on insufficient evidence apart from the common sense and very plausible heuristic that is, if you want to discover something about your inner life, it might make sense to pay close attention to it. And so it really is just a very systematic way of paying very close attention to whatever you in fact notice in each moment. But to go to your question, what begins to happen is when you develop a little concentration in that mode, one, your mental experience becomes very pleasant. The concentration is intrinsically pleasant. So this is certainly many of you who are new to the practice, especially if that was the first 2 minutes you'd ever meditated, it might not have be obvious to you just how ceaselessly your mind was being buffeted by thought and how hard it was to pay attention to the breath. But once you actually develop some concentration, you can pay attention to the breath or to sounds or to anything you focus on, and that ability of mind is incredibly pleasant. Then it becomes like a bit of a drug trip to be just paying attention to the breath or anything. Anything becomes an intrinsic source of pleasure because having a focused mind is very pleasant. And then new meditators begin to associate that mental pleasure with successful meditation. And if you sit down and you don't get that pleasure, you feel like, meditation isn't working anymore. All right, and I gotta get back to that feeling. And then your efforts in meditation become a way of seeking that mental pleasure. And it becomes like anything else in life. You're just seeking happiness by some strategy. Or you're trying to use your mindfulness, your attention to unpleasant experience. Let's say you're feeling sad, or let's say you have pain in your body. You're trying to focus on it for the purpose of driving it away, but for the purpose of changing your experience. And that actually is no longer mindfulness. That's just it's a kind of a corruption of the whole practice. There's a difference between truly accepting what is arising in consciousness in the present moment and investigating it from a point of interest and openness and just having dropped your problem in that moment and subtly trying to change your experience and improve yourself and be better in whatever way you're imagining meditation is going to make you better. And so it's incredibly common forever in meditation practice to keep catching yourself fooled by this subtle effort to the subtle corruption of mindfulness, where you're trying to change something that you thought a moment ago you were just paying attention to.
A lot of people, when they think of meditation, they may have come to it through something like Buddhism. I've got a wall full of Pema Chodron books, or what have you, and you're saying you don't have to go that route. It almost seems very basic. Why is it that for so long, only through religion seems to have been the main route that most people have gotten to this idea of meditation?
Yeah, that's on one level, the answer to that question is it's just an accident of demographics, because basically everyone in human history has been religious in one way or another, so more or less everything has emerged in a religious context. So if you ask, if we inventoried all the roads that were ever built or all the bridges that were ever built, we would find that they were built by religious people. So, why is it that only religious people build bridges? Because there's nobody else to do the job, really. But it is a bit of a conundrum why in the Western philosophical and scientific tradition a really clear and fruitful and disciplined approach to introspection never arose. It was kind of stillborn about 150 years ago, and it petered out more or less in William James's time. But in the East, especially in the tradition of Buddhism, you have just an immensely sophisticated and diligent excavation of the inner landscape of mind from a first-person point of view. Now, of course, this is happening in a context that's almost entirely bereft of science, and so if you go through the wrong door looking for these teachings, you get met by as baroque a display of religiosity and superstition as you could ever hope to find. There's no question there's a disparity between East and West in terms of this kind of contemplative wisdom. And I think the religion of of Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam has something to do with that. I think that, you know, our thinking about what was spiritually possible got framed 2,000 years ago by this sky god religion, and we in the West have had a hard time breaking out of that.
In the book, you talk about moments that have been blissful, whether as a 16-year-old sitting by a lake, older trying ecstasy, he has interesting recollections. Going on a retreat.
I don't know what she's talking about.
Going on a retreat and finally having that moment where it clicks. And I would say many people might say they've had those religious moments. Mm. You're saying you can have them without the religion, but some people would say the religion is not so much about faith sometimes as it is about comfort. That religious moment makes them feel there is a God. There's somebody out there who cares about me, who has a plan, has a destiny. I am a part of something bigger. And if I do it your way, I don't get to have that. And what would you say to them?
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, it's... I'd like to think I'm being facetious, but I'm not quite... it's nowhere written that everything we like or one would might like about religion has a rational analog that you can just swap one for one. And it's the classic example is, you know, when we lose our belief in Santa Claus, we don't get something exactly like Santa Claus to put in that Santa Claus shaped hole in our lives. And that's true of this notion of a God who we can propitiate and who we hope is looking out for us. And I always question the comfort that people claim to get from that paradigm, because you know, no matter what this God seems to be doing in your life, whether he's acting like a perfect travel agent, or he's giving you parking spaces, or it's like all the kind of micromanaging of your well-being that he seems up for. You just, every time you open the paper or turn on the news, you see some harrowing story where he failed some equally faithful person. And these stories are horrific. And you know that in many cases, these people were praying with every ounce of their strength to be saved or to have their children saved, and God didn't accomplish it. So I'm always amazed when someone walks away from a bus accident where 30 people died and they're the lone survivor, and they say, it's by the grace of God that I'm here. I mean, you've got to cut them some slack for just having gone through a bus accident where everybody died, but it's still an incredibly narcissistic and illogical thing to say. It's like, so all those people who are still kind of flaming in the wreckage, were they bad people, or they didn't pray hard enough? I mean, what scheme of what lesson are you drawing from the fact that you were spared? I think it's there isn't that comfort. I don't think there's any reason to think that the universe cares about us. I think the universe cares about us as much as it cared about the dinosaurs, which is to say, not enough. But spirituality doesn't, in principle, have anything to do with believing that the universe cares about you. It need not have anything to do with that. And certainly, what I'm calling spirituality doesn't. It's about recognizing that paying attention to your moment-to-moment experience can reveal certain truths about the nature of your own consciousness that are redeeming in a way, which can mitigate the basis of psychological suffering and the impulse to create suffering for others in ways that are actually analogous to what the kind of testimony that gave us our religions. So I think half of what Jesus said makes a lot of sense. And when he talks about loving your neighbor as yourself, that is a state of consciousness that is available. That's not pie in the sky. That I think is part of the well-attested phenomenology of human experience. And there are meditations that uncover that experience. There are also drugs that uncover that experience. And one of those two is faster.
In talking to a friend who used to do religious retreats, silent retreats, he would say every time he would do them, every birthday he would do them, and he would say inevitably in the middle of the night they'd hear somebody peeling out of the parking lot. They couldn't take the silence and, you know, all of that. And it made me think as I read your book, if you're, we live lives of distraction. We get in the car, we turn on the radio. We go in the house, we turn on the TV. There's always noise, something to pull us out of thinking. Will we like who we meet if we make this effort to find out that consciousness, to lose the chatter? That's kind of a frightening thought.
Well, the chatter is really the unpleasant part of ourselves. It's not the liking who you meet that problem goes away when you cut through the chatter. I mean, there's no guarantee that's going to happen immediately on a retreat, and part of the ordeal of being in an extended period of silent intensive practice is just confronting this wall of noise that is your mind. There's a range of talent, there's a range of interest, there's a range of energy, and there's no telling where you might fall on that spectrum, but very few people are cursed with a fundamental inability not to touch the benefits of this kind of practice. So I think far and away the most common experience is to drop into a way of being which is much more comfortable. And even if for a brief moment, you can taste what it's like to drop the problem of your self, to drop the problem of your becoming somebody in the next moment or in the distant future. And the difference between being identified with the next unhappy thought that arises in consciousness and seeing it merely as a thought is total. So it is possible to, if you don't see the alternative, if you're just condemned to feel identical to the next thought that arises, well then you are hostage to whatever its emotional implications are. So if it's a thought of fear about the future or regret about the past or sadness about something that's happened, then you are just plunged into all of those states, and those states of mind then become the lens through which you perceive the next moment, and they occasion thoughts that seem to justify those states. But if you can actually pay attention to the arising of thought and the arising of emotions, none of these emotions last for more than a few moments. It's impossible to stay angry for even a minute without resurrecting this feeling by thinking without knowing that you're thinking. And that's something that it takes some meditative tools to discover, but because the common experience is just that I was angry for a whole day, you just stayed angry, but you're not seeing this automaticity of thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking about why you ever have every right to be angry. That is actually delivering you the anger in each moment.
Let's turn now to some of your questions. I think there are people with microphones on each side. Raise your hands, and we'll try to get in as many as we can. We'll start with this gentleman here.
Ben Affleck the other night.
Oh.
I told him I wouldn't have to ask. You would ask.
I predicted at least a third of the people in the audience heard that. What I'm wondering is...
Speaking of anger.
Was his demagoguery and ad hominem attack and emotionalism characteristic of the liberal left in a way that the demagoguery and emotionalism and ad hominem attacks on the right is not? Was there something special about that?
Well, there's something special about Ben Affleck. I actually don't know what went on there. I think I actually just wrote a blog post about it on the plane over here today, which I'll probably publish if I wake up in the morning and decide that it makes sense. But it was a very strange experience because I hadn't met him. I didn't meet him before I came out on stage. So there was nothing, we had no experience of one another. And I stepped on stage, and I don't know if it's obvious to all of you as viewers of that show, but that mid-show interview is supposed to be a kind of protected space where the mid-show panelist talks to Bill for 5 to 7 minutes, and then Bill opens it up to the rest of the panel, and then they jump in. And so, and I came out on stage, and Ben jumped in immediately before the subject of Islam ever came up. He jumped in when I said something about the New Age. And so that was odd. And then he jumped in again very angrily with the moment Islam came up. And then he jumped in again. And then that interview was over and we were just sparring. And it was interesting because he hadn't had any direct experience of me. And clearly afterwards, we talked for about an hour after the panel, and he hadn't read any of my work. He didn't really know who I was. So someone had prepared him for this appearance. And they basically, I'm sure they just used Glenn Greenwald or somebody as my publicist and just told him I was a warmonger and a racist and a demagogue and you should try to take this guy's head off. And so I don't have confirmation of that, but that's the only thing that makes his behavior understandable to me, because he was so hostile so quickly. And in fact, it was so bizarre that I didn't even appreciate how hostile he was until I watched it on television the next day. I was sort of getting that I wasn't getting much love from him. But I just, I was burning a lot of fuel trying to convince myself that I was really seeing and hearing what, in fact, I was seeing and hearing, rather than just responding to it. So I think the water has been poisoned on this topic to an astonishing degree. And so that, I mean, the work of people of liberal apologists for Islam, people like Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges and Karen Armstrong and Juan Cole and John Esposito and Scott Atran, and I'll name names, they have made any criticism of Islam in particular synonymous with bigotry, racism, white demagoguery, Fox News. Just take your slander there. But just to try to distinguish Islam on any specific point as being worse than Methodism, say, is synonymous with racism. And what's incredible is that, first of all, the charge of racism makes absolutely no sense, because Islam is not a race, and there are white converts to Islam that if anyone's criticizing Islam, you're talking about them just as much as you're talking about Arabs who are born to the faith, or in fact more so. But what was so strange about that encounter was the point I made was that this has been so politicized and so distorted that to say anything about the ideas contained in the doctrine of Islam and their behavioral consequences is taken as synonymous as an attack on all Muslims as people. And I could not even finish that sentence before what I just said was taken as synonymous as an attack on all Muslims as people. And then the entire conversation was derailed trying to just salvage that. So people get emotionally hijacked on this. And clearly he was hijacked. And, I don't know I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt that he had been poisoned in advance. But,
Where did it end? An hour in the green room? Were you guys buds or you didn't convince him?
Well, he was much nicer afterwards. And I feel like I made a little headway with him, but the truth is, the overwhelming impression you get, as you might expect, is that Ben Affleck is very satisfied to be Ben Affleck. That's understandable. I'd like to try being Ben Affleck for a little while. It's hard to convince him that he's not understanding what you're saying. And so I can't say that we had a true meeting of the minds, but it was a lot better than it seemed on the panel. I can say that.
When you get Bill Maher to say, "I give up," that's great. Tells you something. There's a lady in the back corner on the wall. Short, dark hair, right there. Yes, you.
What are your experiences with and thoughts on Christopher Hitchens?
I didn't spend nearly as much time with Hitch as I would have loved to. That was one of the, personally, one of the losses. I really felt like we were just hitting our stride as colleagues and friends, and I was going to get the benefit of his wisdom and just the pleasure of his company for many years to come. And so that was very disappointing. I wrote in a blog post after he died that we did a debate together in Los Angeles against two rabbis, and he was already very, very sick, and I was amazed that he made the trip. It just didn't even make sense to me that he would have at that point. And we had dinner together before the debate, and I was shocked to realize this was the first time he and I had ever had dinner alone, and it was almost certainly going to be the last time. And so that was pretty poignant. Also, the debate was on actually the topic you raised about belief in an afterlife and belief in a God that cares for us, specifically on the point of the afterlife. I'm certainly sad not to have gotten more of him, and he was tremendous fun and impossible to emulate. I mean, he's someone who, when we did a debate together in Mexico City, this is before he had his diagnosis, and all the seemingly hyperbolic stories about his drinking and his carousing, and I mean, they almost are all certainly true. Because the two experiences I had of this sort, one was when I first met him. Actually, the first dinner I had with him, we were drinking until maybe 1 in the morning, and I left him totally hammered at his hotel in Los Angeles, and he was clearly not done. I went home to bed, and he was still going to be out. And then I woke up the next morning with a hangover. Realizing, he has to be on a panel this morning at the Los Angeles Book Festival, so like with my toe, I turn on the television, and I see him on a panel at this now like 8:30 in the morning, 9 in the morning. He could not have had more than 3 hours sleep, and again, he drank like a shipload of sailors the night before. And he was just absolutely lucid, speaking, that perfect, as though he wrote it from the teleprompter prose, and looking great. So, the other example I have of his, which just made no sense to me at the time, was we did this debate in Mexico, and at midnight after the debate, I catch him at the bar. He's eating a club sandwich and drinking scotch. And then I discover that he has a car picking him up in 2 hours. He has to get on a plane from Mexico City to fly to D.C. to do a debate that night. And there was just going to be no sleep involved. He was just going from the club sandwich and the scotch to the plane to the debate. So that's not the way I roll. He could do it. He pulled it off. So, yeah.
I'm a big fan, and not to get ahead of your success with Waking Up, but like, what's next? You hit us with Lying and then Waking Up, and just curious what's to come next.
In terms of a big book, I don't know what is going to be the next project, but I have one project that just emerged kind of spontaneously in the last few weeks that I'm excited about, especially in light of what happened the other night with on Real Time. This Muslim reformer, Majid Nawaz, who I've been occasionally tweeting about, and who I had never collaborated with before, is someone I'm in dialogue now with. We're kind of going back and forth, it started out almost like a debate, but now it's just more of an interesting conversation, and we're going to take a little more time and do it right and then release it as an ebook in the next couple of months. And Manjeet is just the perfect person for me to be talking to, because he calls himself a revolutionary Islamist. He was not quite a jihadist. He was not actually going to blow himself up on a bus, but he was trying to engineer a coup in Pakistan, and he was just in with all the guys who are certain of paradise, and he was certain of it, and he spent 5 years in an Egyptian prison. And then maybe you should look him up, or if you follow me on social media, you'll see me retweeting his stuff. But he's a very articulate, smart, interesting guy who has made the full trip back from Islamism to a secular commitment to reforming Islam. But he's not an atheist. He's actually trying to reform Islam. But unlike people like Reza Aslan, he doesn't lie about the doctrine of Islam. He will admit that there's a straight line from certain doctrines to certain horrible behaviors, and that we have to find some way of reforming the faith. What the Muslim world needs are reformers who are going to say, yes, we're sorry, all this stuff about apostasy is terrible, and we have to find some lens through which to reformulate our view of it. And so we're having a dialogue there, and anyway, I'm excited about that dialogue. It's going to be useful.
Let's get somebody in the back. Any one of those hands in the back there. I see that young man there, yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about Noam Chomsky. He was being interviewed at a press conference like this. And he said that you and Christopher Hitchens and others, your religion of anti-theism, that's what you're trying to make your philosophy into. Just
right.
Like... what we have with Jesus Christ is Christian,
right,
Jewish,
right.
Muslim religions. And others that say that your philosophy and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins even, who wrote The God Delusion, and that you're just as dogmatic and intolerant as the believers.
Right.
How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, the response is pretty simple. Many people have made that claim. It's just a trick of language to say, well, you're just as fundamentalist as the fundamentalists, or you're just as dogmatic as the dogmatists. When you actually look at what we're saying that certain of these claims, like the Bible is the perfect word of the creator of the universe, written by an omniscient being, could not have been produced by a human mind, these claims are quite crazy. They have no evidentiary basis, and we're not accepting those claims. And once you don't accept those claims, these religions fall apart. And what's interesting to notice is that every person, no matter how religious, is doing the same thing we're doing to every other religion. So every Christian is doing exactly what I'm doing to Islam. You know, they hear what Muslims say about the Quran being the perfect word of the creator of the universe, and they find it uncompelling. They see this echo chamber of Islamic conversation to be a tissue of wishful thinking and failures of critical reason. And their Christians are not losing any sleep over the question of whether to convert to Islam. Now, Muslims are obviously returning the favor. Muslims look at what Christians are up to, and they say, "There's no reason to believe any of that. Look at all of the self-deception, and look at these assumptions that are not actually justified." So the atheist is just doing what everyone else is doing to all of these religions and to thousands of other religions that they don't care about. So everyone in this room is a Chomskyan-style fundamentalist dogmatist around ISIS, and not ISIS the group, but ISIS the goddess, or Zeus or Apollo or Thor or any of the thousands of dead gods who it would be an embarrassment to take seriously. And there's nothing you have to claim on insufficient evidence to reject Poseidon. And if someone comes to you saying, no, you really have to take Poseidon seriously, they have to adduce reasons. And when you see that these reasons are profoundly uncompelling, well, then you're not a dogmatist or a fundamentalist to not be compelled by them. They just don't pass the smell test.
Let's try to go. I just see an arm in black there. Please stand up. Yes, the one who's waving. Yeah.
So I have a question, not about the literal truthfulness of any religion, but about the function of religion in society. And that even from a psychological perspective, there's lots of work done studying what function does religion play in terms of transcendence and managing the terror of existence and meaninglessness and so on. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, what are the dangers of what you're propounding, not in terms of the truthfulness of what you're saying, with which I completely agree, but with society's inability to literally internalize what you're saying, you know, the bigger impact of what you're saying given the functional role of religion across the world?
Right. Well, I would point out that we've run that psychological experiment in certain societies to the apparent benefit of those societies in many ways. So if you look at Western Europe, if you look at the level of atheism in Denmark and Iceland and Sweden and even France, and I mean, it's just there's a level of doubt about these consoling myths that should compel us to believe that it's possible to have a functioning society and moral people, etc., without managing the terror, as you say, in quite that way. The other thing I would point out is that religious ideas don't merely manage terror; they actually terrify people much of the time. So, you can say that a belief in heaven manages the terror of death and bereavement, etc., but a belief in hell also, frankly, terrorizes people. You know, I hear from people who were truly terrorized as children with a fear of hell, you know, whose parents told them, listen, if you don't do X, Y, and Z or believe X, Y, and Z, you're going to wind up, you know, burning in hellfire for eternity. And not only that, I mean, there's that, but then there's also just the communication, which is often explicit, that, you know, I won't love you anymore if you doubt these propositions, and I will disown you, and you'll never get to talk to me again. And that's, I can't tell you how many people I've heard from who have lost their families or knew they would lose their families or are afraid to tell anyone of their doubts because no one they've ever met has expressed any doubt about these outrageous propositions, and now they're living in total isolation and just sending me an email to have a conversation. There's a lot of suffering that goes unacknowledged, and even some of it goes unacknowledged even by someone like me most of the time. I was surprised to learn when I was talking about, I gave this talk at one atheist convention called entitled Death in the Present Moment. Which turned out to be a very useful talk. And one of the points I made there is I just conceded that this belief in heaven really does do some serious heavy lifting for people and consoles people when their children die or when they lose the people closest to them. And just the belief that you're going to be reunited with everyone you love, that has to be consoling. And so I sort of left it at that. And then I got an email from a woman who said, well, listen, it's not actually merely consoling, because I've been that person. I was in a fundamentalist community. I did lose someone closest to me. And I was terribly sad for a very long time. And what I felt was that all the people around me who were also fundamentalists, who were just said, you know, don't, you know, essentially, don't worry, you're going to be reunited. He's, you know, he's with Jesus now, and you're going to see him in a blink of an eye. All those people were actually not connecting with my grief. They were not. I felt isolated from these people. Their compassion was, it was not really compassion. It was this very facile way of cutting off the relationship, because on some level they're terrified of death too, and they have whatever tiny doubts they have about the truth of all this, and this is just a way of everyone being somehow shut down and paranoid together. And then what's more, the duration of her grief began to seem tantamount to a lack of faith. I mean, so why are you crying in the first place if you are sure that the person you love most in the world is now in a better place and that you will be with him or her in that place eventually? That doesn't really, that's a good outcome. And if you're miserable for weeks and months, that seems to be synonymous with a lack of faith. And that begins to look weird in the community. So it's a very, I think we have been, we should be slow to be convinced that believing things for bad reasons is likely to pay enormous dividends in some way that we haven't directly experienced.
So I find out that the rest of the world is much more religious than where I came from. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is that I myself is an atheist, a non-believer, but in order to be an atheist, you need to be moderately educated. You have to be some intellectual, independent thinker, and non-conformist, because the rest of the world are more religious. Mm. So you and also Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens, I read their book, they all preach people to be non-religious. But how can you be successful when majority of people don't even accept evolution, don't even have the moderate level of education? Right. It's just hopeless approach.
Well, the truth is you don't have to be well-educated to be an atheist. You just don't have to be if you're simply not indoctrinated into a belief system, you are by default going to be an atheist. I mean, there are 1,000 gods no one in this room believes in, and you didn't have to marshal any great effort, educationally or otherwise, to keep those gods in abeyance. You just didn't get inducted into the cult of those gods. And you know, I've got a 5.5-year-old daughter. She's an atheist simply because no one ever gave her religion. So that in a single generation, this problem could be solved. You know, So the question is what is going to get the current generation of parents to not foist this raft of illusions onto their children, and short of that, to not foist it to the degree that has been was true in the past. And what I think that's, it's not any one person's great heroic effort. It's just the ceaseless collisions between religion and science, and religion and secular values, and religion and too much information that's just happening day by day. And I think it's all of those. Every time that happens, religion tends to lose ground. There's no question about which we once had a scientific answer, but now the best answer is religious. Okay? There are uncountable number of questions that once had a religious answer, and now the best answer is scientific or otherwise secular. And that's just a unilateral seeding of ground that I think is going to continue. I'm hopeful, but also impatient. Yes, we need education.
We've got time for one last question, and I saw this lady's hand right there. Yes, you.
Hello. I was raised in atheist society, mm-hmm. former Yugoslavia, where nobody practiced religion at all. We were very early thought that religion and what was done in history in the name of religion, we were told it's an opium of the masses, which is the famous Marxist saying. So when I came to this country, I was stunned how religious American people are compared to the Europeans. My children never went to church. We went to churches for reason of architecture, when we studied Gothic architecture or Renaissance. And so I raised children without religion here too. Often had questions whether I was doing the right thing or not. Mm. Lo and behold, they grew up very conscious human being, highly socially conscious, wonderful human beings, never went to church. don't claim to be any religion whatsoever. So I'm wondering, how was that possible? It's one thing the socialists did well. Did not teach us to believe in a religion of any sort. So you are a breath of fresh air for me who still seek some answer of what is meaning of, where is the truth, where this real truth lies. And I'm extremely fascinated about your self-transcendence that you talk in your book. I saw glimpses of it occasionally, almost get it, but then it's hard.
Nice. Well,
thank you.
Good luck with that part of it. That's the center of the project. But on your point about how it's possible for people to have rich, ethical, high-functioning lives without religion, that, again, I don't think you actually think it's a mystery, but many people think this is a mystery or a problem that has to be solved. But just it has things exactly backwards. We are the source of the wisdom we pretend to find in Scripture. So the religious person reads, the Christian reads the Bible today, and they see Jesus in half his moods being just a fount of ethical wisdom, and then the other half they ignore. And they do that based on their own ethical intuitions and all the ways in which they've been tuned up by modern conversation about right and wrong and human well-being. And so it's there's when a Christian or a Jew reads Deuteronomy or Leviticus or Exodus and sees these crazy passages about stoning people to death for working on the Sabbath, say, it's their own ethical wisdom that reject them or contextualize them or find some reason to ignore them. And so it's we are the cash value of all the wisdom in these books is our own minds and our own larger conversation with other human beings. And so it really isn't a mystery. I mean, all we have is ourselves and our conversation with others. And these books are a kind of reified old conversation. The Bible is a 2,000-year-old or more conversation, and the Quran is a 1,400-year-old conversation. And then we have a 21st-century conversation, and then people keep trying to bring in these indigestible and supposedly perfect forms of conversation into the mix. And we just have to... But in every case, it's our own truth-testing that is acknowledging the wisdom or acknowledging the irrelevance of these documents.
I'm sure a lot of you still have questions. It's time for Sam to go and be able to sign books. If you head outside, you'll get everybody will get an opportunity to buy.
Thank you very much.
And have a moment with them.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.